So here, I'm just checking that this is working, and it seems to be so. Let's hope. Well, last night, for those of you who are only coming by day, I talked a little bit about prayer as an introduction to prayer. This morning is a whopping topic, but I'm going to do it very gently with you. I'm going to talk about God. Now, all our concepts of God are necessarily imperfect, even wrong. But because we're talking about the most wonderful, mysterious reality. But it is important, isn't it, to check when our concepts are wrong, to correct them. Because the aim of thinking is to point us towards the mystery, not away from it. And if our ideas of God are radically misconceived, and prayer is communion with God, as we saw, I just want to play with you for a while to see if we can clarify a bit or purify or redirect when we use the word God, what are we actually saying? Now, to dare to give a talk on that is perhaps crazy because it's so big, but that's what I'm going to do. One thing that's wonderful that's happened in our world, and you're very conscious of this, is the scientific method. Science is a wonderful gift of human intelligence. It's even got us to the moon and beyond. And you know about the World Wide Web, and you probably know about computers that don't work, like mine didn't last night, and the complexities of all that, but it's absolutely wonderful, you'd admit. One of the most wonderful things that science has done has helped, not entirely, liberate us, because our judgments are supposed to be based on evidence, tested evidence. That's the scientific method, isn't it? And go back a few years, we used to burn witches. People have behaved horribly, still do, in our world in the name of God and in the name of religion. And science has come in and it's freed us from submission to authority when it's untested. Theological as well, Vatican as well, me as well here. We've got ways of testing things, and the children are absolutely convinced of this, as this is their world. They won't really accept anything unless they can experience it. Whereas when I was young, I believed my mother and I believed my teachers, and mostly that was for good because they were wonderful people. If they hadn't have been, I'd be in a mess. But we took things in an abstract kind of a way and we trusted and believed them, whereas I think, I hope I'm right, you're looking at me as though I'm wrong, but anyhow, I'm doing my best. We want to be tested by evidence. It has to be an experience somehow that makes sense to us. And science has radically helped us in that regard. So we thank God for the intelligent world. However, and this is the however, and now I've just got some pictures to show you for a little while. Experience, look at your own experience, I look at mine, look at what's going to happen these days here. It's not limited to what can be tested by the scientific method. So that quite imperfect, because I'm not much good at this, picture of nature. Well, you know, when you've walked in nature, you know some things, but you can't. They're beyond testing. We experience some things that are beyond logic and beyond the scientific mind's ability to test. And we can't put everything in a little glass tube and Bunsen burner and check it out scientifically. We can't do that with nature. We don't want to do it with nature. And we know that most of the things we know, is it worth reminding you of this, we know because of love. Love actually opens us. Parental love, sisterly love, every kind of love, opens us to insights that the mind, logical mind, can't get to, not meant to get to it. The world is bigger than the surface that can be tested by science. There's another little example. That's the world, as you know, taken from outer space many years ago. And that's our little blue planet. That's us. And I remember when I first saw it, I think it was getting on for nearly 30 years ago, it would be, I think, when they took this from outer space, and you look at it and it's actually changed. It's changed everybody's way of thinking. Not everybody, sadly, because there are still wars going on that lovely little place. What a crazy business. We all belong together. We all need each other. We need the environment. We need the animals. We need the trees. We need you. We need every racial person, because we're all part of this beautiful place. The bit you can see right up on the top is, of course, Saudi Arabia and the Red Sea. And the Mediterranean is just right on the top there. And Israel would be, you could work out what that is for yourself. And most of what you see there is Africa. So that's our beautiful planet. And by looking at it, you know some things that you can't test scientifically. You're in communion with, and your mind is opened, and you have insights. Let's try a few more just briefly, and I won't spend time on this. Look at that wonderful aeroplane that they stopped because it had an accident. But what a genius thing. Created by science, created by very careful... But once you look at it and see it in flight, you go into flight too, and you know some things about yourself and the world, and I'll say God in a minute because that's what we're talking about, that can't be tested scientifically. Look at that. You're not, probably not supposed to look at it too often, but there it is. That's Apollo and Daphne. And he was determined to get her, so she turned into a shrub, a Daphne. If anyone here is called Daphne, this is not meant in any way to imply anything at all about your life. But there it is. And people learn through love, through sexual love, through communion. You know, we know things that are beyond science. But where you can test things by science, you must do so. There's a painting by Edvard Munch, I've forgotten what he is, he's Scandinavian anyhow, artist that you probably know very well. It's called Le Cri, I think, in French, the cry or the scream. It's very frightening or something, whatever the feeling you get when you look at it, but there's something happening there that's beyond science, beyond testing. So there you have, in a very simple way, the Japanese radical on the left, an abbreviated radical for the word heart, and on the right is the two make the kanji for, that's destruction, and that's too busy. Isogashi in, I don't know Japanese, but I know this. So isogashi means too busy. Too busy. And every language has its own wonderful way of expressing it. And they don't express it through letters, of course, Japanese. It's pictures that say something. I remember talking once, and there was a Japanese person sitting there, and they knew their own language, but they didn't know this. Just as you don't know why we call that thing that's just been beautifully covered a window. You might happen to know, but we call it a window. And usually when I ask people why, they haven't the faintest idea. And I wouldn't, except that when I was 13, I was told, 60-something years ago. It's the eye of the wind, the windoi in French, or windoch, if you Langadoc. So it's the eye of the wind. So forget the glass. That's why somebody hundreds of years ago called that hole in the wall a window. Because the wind would look in at you on your distaff and would say g'day and be part of your life. So we use words without, well, if you say you're too busy, and if you're not too busy, I'd be terribly surprised. I don't care how old you are or whatever you're doing, because we live in a culture that's too busy and we get swept up in it, don't we? It's easy to be too busy, but if you're too busy, your heart is being destroyed. Because you're not, I'm not, connecting. I'm not in communion. And we saw last night that prayer is communion with God. So somewhere here, we're talking about this extraordinary mystery that we call God. So let's move to that. We've got another wonderful word in English called religion. And please don't let people destroy it on us. And when people come up and say, look, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, take not the slightest bit of notice of them, because they're clearly wrong. It's radically wrong. Spiritual can just about mean, it's a beautiful word too, but when you say you're spiritual and you're not religious, it's a cop-out. It's a missing the mark. The word religion means binding back, ligo, Latin, ligament, or ligation, whatever. So to religo is to bind something back that's been too busy spinning around, doing this, doing that. And as we saw last night, John of the Cross, what's the good of doing one thing for God if he wants you to do something else? So we're not in touch often, perhaps, with our heart. We're not in touch with our cry. We're not in touch with this wonderful universe, world that we're part of. We're out of sync with ourselves and with others, and a religious experience is any experience that binds us back to the center. Gets it, like hopefully this week will be for me and for you. Insofar as we're out of touch with the center, our own center, and the center of the world, and the center of the world, of course, is God. Look up the top. Why do we use the word God? Well, let's go back to Hindi. Ours is an Indo-European language, of course. Let's go back to the oldest extant from which Hindi comes, and the oldest extant language in the Indo-European group of languages is Sanskrit. And in Sanskrit, the hard G, the G sound, means calling, called. It's the verb to call. And the T, or God in English, or Gott in German, or whatever, that is the one. So when you say God, you actually mean, this is what the word means, the one called, or the one calling. So a religious experience is actually being in touch with the center, and God is, this is profound, but let's have a go at it. God is Taya de Chardin, the heart and the beyond of everything. So if I'm not in touch with the heart, I'm not in touch with God. I'm out of touch. If I'm in touch with the heart, and to the extent that we are in touch with our own heart, or the heart of other people, or the heart of the world, or the heart into which artists take us in song and dance and architecture and music and whatever, painting, if we're not in touch with the heart, we're not in touch with God. But when we are in touch with the heart, and you know this, I'm just reminding you of your own experience, when you get in touch with the heart, you're in touch with a mystery, a beyond. It's infinite. You can't, it's not practical, it's not locked in, it's not able to be tested by the scientific method. But you're in touch with something that takes you into transcendence. Your own heart does that, and so does love, and so does any heart at all. So God, I think Tayyad puts it beautifully, is the heart of everything and the beyond of everything. So now let me try and say something that... I'll try and say it sensibly as best I'm able to. There's a danger, I have the danger, so you might have it, of thinking of the tree does something, produces fruit or flower or whatever. The birds do things. Around here it's lovely. So they chirp and they squabble and they whatever else they do, they cackle and they sound like a convent of nuns sometimes. Birds do all these beautiful things out there and they fly. And you do something, and I do something, and wait for it, and, plus sign, God does something. So there's God, and there's you, and there's you, and there's me, and there's this, and there's that, and there's something else. Well, if that's our idea of God, and it probably is lurking there, because it's very hard to get our imagination around this, then our idea of God is radically wrong. So if God is up in heaven and you're down on earth, well, you're not talking about God. I don't know what you're talking about. You're using the word, but you're using it wrongly. God is the heart of everything. God acts always through, philosophically, God, the prime cause, acts through all the secondary causes. What the tree is doing, God is doing through the tree. God is holding you in existence. We've got to add a very important thing in a moment to qualify this. And the important thing is freedom. God wonderfully, when he made you, in fact, when he made the universe, I think, and when he made the animal world, but when he made you and me, God didn't want automatons. He didn't want necessary locked-in beings. He wanted you to be able to say yes or no and took that risk. Because if you couldn't say yes, well, you couldn't love, you couldn't have compassion, you couldn't do anything that was beautiful and that God longs for, communion, it would be something you had to do. It would be just automatic. And God would be the puppeteer, pulling the strings and organizing everything. And God wanted you and me, our human world, to bring to consciousness what's happening everywhere, to give expression to it, and to freely say yes to the communion we talked about last night. God is wanting you to be in this beautiful communion, but as he did with Mary at the incarnation, he asked her. She could have said no. How many other people did say no? I don't know. Why is Jesus Jesus and why is Mary Mary? It's because Mary actually said yes to this mystery. But it could have been any number of people before who didn't say yes. I don't know. No point of guessing or speculating. But this wonderful young woman said, "Let it be done to me as you have said." What a wonderful yes that she continued right through to the cross. The yes. Jesus said yes. Paul calls Jesus the yes to God's promises. So he said, "Let it be, yes, freely." And that's absolutely beautiful. And you know that. Don't have to impress that on you. So it's the yes that's there. So come back to God. When you and I, we'll just talk about us for a minute because we can't talk about everybody. When you and I say yes to the inspiration and the call and the invitation and the initiation of God, because we're in touch with our heart where this happens, to the extent that you say yes, you enter into prayer, whatever you're doing, because you're saying yes to God, of course. But we can say no, or we can ignore, or we can miss, or we can be too busy to be in touch with the center. And so we're doing sometimes quite good things that are irrelevant and unproductive, but they pass the time and they're not bad, they're just useless. Or we can do bad things that hurt, destroy ourselves and others, We can sin, we can miss the mark, as we talked last night, to all the extent of venial sin, I think we used to say, and what a good word, and mortal. We can kill things with our behaviour. All of that's possible. God allows it. But God is not up there doing things separate from you. He's doing it through you, if you allow it. If you don't allow it, it doesn't happen. And God accepts that. With tears, with, like Jesus in the garden to Judas, why do you betray me with a kiss? The incomprehensibility of human beings behaving like this. So where does God touch us? Where do we connect with the one we call God? And I hope I'm being clear, at least as clear as I can. When we say God, we're not talking about something extra, as though there's you and you and you and God, because that would make God finite. It would make God like any other being, just an extra one. No, God is the heart, your heart. God is the heart of everything. God is the... But we can, and thanks again to the scientific method, we've been helped not to. We can, people do in God's name dreadful things. In the names of religion, they do dreadful things. We do. So where do we experience God? I'll just can't cover it all, and I don't intend to, and you don't need me to. We experience God in nature. I know you know that. We experience God in people, in events. Even in the crucifixion, we experience God, which is extraordinary. We experience God in words that are spoken and written, in works of art. And why do we experience God there? Because everything reveals something of the beauty and the goodness of the transcendent God. And when a new baby is born into your world, your great niece has a child, or wherever you're up to, I'm up to there in here by now, seem to be, I knew I was great, but now I'm great, I think, overdoing it. But whatever, when a new child is born into your world, your idea of God changes. I hope it grows, because God has now revealed God at the heart of a new, unique creature. So it shifts, it grows, it expands, it penetrates. In fact, every time someone walks into the room, every time you meet any other person in this world, your idea of God should, will, must expand. Every time you experience anything new, this happens. Jared Manley Hopkins, if I may allow myself to read it to you again, this wonderful Jesuit who, he says everything I've tried to say in 10 minutes now, so simply. The world, he said, is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil. It gathers to a greatness like the ooze of oil crushed. Why do men then now not reck, not understand, not reckon on his rod? Generations have trod, and all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And where's man's smudge? And shares man's smell? And the soil is bare now, nor can foot feel being shod. And for all this, nature is never spent. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things. And though the last lights off the black west went, oh, morning at the brown brink eastward springs, because the Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with warm breath. And ah, bright wings. You can't write like that unless you're in touch with your own heart and with God. When it comes to writing. Well, of course, God is revealed in all of these. In the Hindu Vedas and Upanishads, every book is written by God, by people, by the way. God doesn't write. He inspires, but we do the writing. So in the Vedas and the Upanishads, we have an imperfect, because imperfect people wrote them, response to God, but we can find God there, and you know that, in the sayings of Confucius. Better light a candle, he said, than to curse the dark. That's pretty good. And if ever you find yourself, and you probably will, cursing the dark, like a provincial decision, or like a change in the weather, or like being shifted from one community to another, and you like being where you are, and you curse the dark, or you curse might be too strong a word, but you know, I presume you're capable of all these sinful things. Well, when you find yourself doing it, Confucius is there saying, hey, it's better to light a candle than to curse the dark. Because you can blossom anywhere, light a candle. Gautama the Buddha, the oracles of the Hebrew scriptures, the New Testament, the Muslim Quran, the mystics and poets of every... That's where we can be connected to by God, anywhere there, some more than others, of course. But now let's go to another important point that I hope is part of the logic of what I'm presenting. Here's the danger. We can imagine God, what else can we do, based on our experiences. And that's what we should be doing. But we can end up, and the human race does end up doing this, creating God in our own image, which has got it all back the front. Because we're too sure. Go back to apartheid in South Africa, which is easy because it's over there. And the image of God was created according to their very narrow Christian view. Go to Australia for years when Irish Catholics weren't the only ones, but they were among them, who took their gun out and just shot Aborigines because they'd taken their sheep and they weren't really human. And it goes on and on and on. And sometimes in the name of God. So we can create God in our own image. Look at the dangers of institutionalized religion. Necessary as it is, important as it is, and beautiful as it is, these are the dangers as I see it. On the left-hand side of the picture I'm offering you is a schema of Judaism as a religion, as an institutionalized religion, which I respect, of course, you'd have to, but I want to show you the dangers of it. On the right-hand side is the dangers of Islam as an institutionalized religion, and down the bottom is the dangers of Christianity when it's fundamentalist. And you know about this, you see it everywhere. All I'm asking you to do, I'm asking myself to do, is grab a mirror and look at your own image of God and see where we may be doing the same in our own way. We probably are. Judaism and Islam both have a prophet. Now, the prophet isn't seen as the revelation of God. Moses wasn't the revelation. He was the prophet through whom the revelation was made. Muhammad wasn't the revelation of God, but God spoke through him. Both religions have a book, which is the revelation. And herein lies the problem. The book through whom the revelation, which is the revelation of God, come through Moses, inverted commas, is the Torah. And if you're a real, strict, fundamentalist Jew, you must do what's in the Torah. You eat this or you don't eat this. Thank God there's no temple, so they don't have to get caught up in all the animal sacrifices, but still, that's the mentality. Over here, if you're a really strongly believing Muslim, you must do what the Quran says, particularly what it says about women, if you're a man. And you know a little bit about that. So, and in both religions, the key response to God of the institution wonderful as it can be, is obedience, submission. In fact, Islam means submission. Inshallah, whatever God wills, do. So that's what's happening. Is it touching the heart? Obviously, yes, often. And there are saints in all these religions, clearly. But it needn't touch the heart. They can be doing just what the book says to do in obedience to God without communing, without prayer, without being in communication. Come down to fundamentalist Christianity. I'm using the word in a general sense. We've got a book too, the New Testament. And some people think the New Testament is the revelation. No, it's not. The New Testament is a response to the revelation. The New Testament was written by Matthew in response to where we're going to go in a moment. Mark wrote, John wrote, Luke wrote, James wrote, Jude wrote. You with me? These are people, thank God, beautifully giving us their response to the revelation. But it's not the revelation. It isn't the revelation. We've got a book called The Catechism. It's about that thick. You've probably all read it all. I hope you have. Anyhow, I have because I have to, and that's all right. It's quite a good book. But it's not the revelation. It's the best shot that a certain number of people who were experts in their own right to summarise our response. Let's look at the revelation. I will do that in a moment. Our world is growing with atheists. I'm not presuming this room's full of them, but you never know. And you might be just on the edge of it. And I used to love saying at Kippax, and no one burnt me at the stake yet, the second best thing to be in this world is an atheist. Second best, don't miss that bit. Because at least an atheist has got rid of all these false gods, cleared the deck. But it's only the second best thing. It's better to have an empty ignorance of God than to be cluttered with false gods. Another possibility in our world is agnosticism, which is rampant. It's all too hard, so let's leave it. Be just agnostic. I don't know, I don't know, I don't know. Could be, maybe not, maybe yes. So let's get on with making sure we've got the right shares and we've got the best this and the best that and two of those and something else, and let's get on with life, so-called. But it's too boring, my dear sisters, and it's too small. Because to buy out of the pursuit and search and communion with God is to buy out of life. It's to just whirl around in a too busy place, nothing happening. So, here we go. Christianity is unique in this world, and it's a wonderful gift. And what's unique about Christianity is that beautiful Jesus. I looked at it with you last night, I'll look at it with you again. And he is the revelation. Thank God, it's a person. You can't put him in a book between two covers, and you can't lock him into any writing. But Paul will take you to Jesus, Matthew will take you to Jesus, Mark will take you to Jesus, Luke will take you to Jesus. And the wonderful thing about the New Testament, when you compare it to the other documents that are not in the New Testament, which are hopeless looking things, really, the New Testament, they all point in the one direction. Jesus isn't vague. Those who experienced him experienced something, someone who was incredibly touched. Well, here it is, I'll read you the first words of the first letter of John. We declare to you, says John. This is written after the gospel, so we're right in the last years of the first century. We declare to you what we've heard. Go back to, it's based on experience, you see. It's not theory. It's not a great idea that might take over the world. It's an experience. What we've heard, what we've seen with our eyes, what we've looked at and touched with our hands in the rowing boat and on the fields and in the carpenter shop and wherever they were. It's about the word of life, the life that was revealed, life, real life, revealed, and we've seen it, and we're testifying to it, and we're declaring to you, says this man at the end of his long life, we're declaring to you the eternal life. And eternal doesn't mean starting with death. Eternal means not bound by space and time. It's life beyond everything, the heart and beyond of everything, the moment in communion with God. So that's not bound by time and space. It's eternal life that was with the Father, of course, and was revealed to us. And there he is. We declare to you what we've seen and what we've heard, so that you may have communion with us. And here we are at the heart of the church. It needs to be an institution. It needs organisation. You know that everything. Convents need organisation. So do monasteries. So does everything. Road rules. We need road rules or we'd never get anywhere. We need to organise, yes. But that's necessary and dangerous. It's meant to take us into communion. It's meant to liberate us to be a unique, free human being who is on the road to sanctity. Our communion that he wants us to be in is communion with the Father and with his Son Jesus. And there's the translation of that little text that Jesus is holding in the icon. So once again, we did it last night, but those of you who weren't here, look in the eyes of Jesus and hear him say to you, he's the revelation. The book's about him. It's a response to him, and it's a beautiful response to him. But he's the revelation. Come to me, all you that are weary and carrying heavy burdens, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. It's a double yoke, so he's carrying it with you. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your soul. Jesus takes us into the Trinitarian life. There's Jesus in the centre, the blue of heaven and the brown of the clay, so the incarnation, as you can tell. And if you look at his eyes, they're looking straight at the Father who's in gold, because he always wants to do the Father's will. I always do what pleases him, he said. Wonderful. That's what we're all asked to do. And that's what it means to be made in the image of God. And where's Jesus is looking straight across here to the Holy Spirit, because it's the Spirit. The Spirit is his communion with the Father. The Spirit is his energy, his life, his agenda, his what he's doing. And that's the Spirit who is carrying out the will of God through Jesus, through the Word. And the Spirit is looking straight down here at where we're going to go later this morning at the Eucharist. And there are four sides to the table, and you're obviously the fourth. Each of you is invited to be the fourth at the table. And at that Eucharistic table, the Spirit is inviting you into communion with God. If I could sing, I used to be able to, but I'm crackly now. Starry, Starry Night, Vincent. So there's Vincent van Gogh. That's not bad, is it? And that's you. You and a mate of yours. Enjoying the wonder of it all. Because God is the heart and beyond of everything. And we've got this wonderful cosmos that is a gift to us. Tintoretto, there's another little image of communion. Of eating and drinking and my body, my blood, my life, Jesus. So if when we use the word God, we mean what we experience when we're in touch with another person there in the communion, there, because you can be there and not in touch. Once I was in a hurry somewhere over in America, and I was looking at the went to Canada first to do something on philosophy, that's another matter, and got a bus down to wherever the Niagara Falls are, somewhere near Buffalo, I think, anywhere, wherever they are. And I heard this voice behind me from the bus saying, "Snap it, darling, we'll look at it later." So they took a photo so that they could enjoy looking at it in the album. I thought, well, why don't you look at it? You've got time to look at it. Anyhow, that's, we're all different. And we all do that in many ways. Holiness. Now, you're called to holiness. You ready? Which is, what is holiness? Well, here's the Vatican Council, Lumen Gentium, number 39. The holiness of the Church, this wonderful institution we're in, with its dangers, but with its gift, the holiness of the Church is constantly shown forth in the fruits of grace, which the Spirit, instructed by the Father through the Word, the Son, which the Spirit produces in the faithful, those who believe. How's your Dutch? Believe means to be in love. It doesn't mean to answer the right questions in an exam paper on religion. Though that's a good thing to do too. Better to have the right answers than the wrong answers. Nobody, you teachers know that. But if you think that's what religion is, you haven't done too well. It's the faith, it's the believers, it's those who are in love with the heart of reality. And so it must be. It's expressed, this holiness, in many ways by those who, each in his or her own state of life, and here's a wonderful statement, tend to the perfection of love. That's holiness. So the thief on the cross, who let's presume was in a mess, had wasted his life, or at least he got caught, and he's being crucified by the Romans, and he's got no hope, no future, no nothing, and his past is all over the place. Because he listened and was next to Jesus, he took a step towards the perfection of love, and Jesus snaffled him up and said, "This day you'll be with me in paradise." That's holiness. He became a saint pretty quickly, that bloke. Well, he was pretty close to Jesus, so that's not a bad place to be. You might even find just, well, of course, I might be talking to people who've been saints for so long it's boring, but it shouldn't be. So tending to the perfection of love, is not, we're not supposed to be perfect, we're supposed to be tending to that, and we can all take one step of love today. And if so, that's wonderful. Communion with God is the most satisfying communion we can experience. As long as you've got, when you say God, you're not thinking of another being who's up in heaven. Communion with God is the most satisfying communion we can experience, for it's communion for which we most long, all of us. We know this. St. Augustine said, and you know it, "You've made us for yourself, O God, and our heart is restless till it rest in you." This is what we're all, everyone in the world wants this. And think, you've been graced by your parents and religious communities and people you've taught and nursed and loved, and so have I. They've alerted us to what it is we really want. Jesus promised the Samaritan woman, "The water I'll give you He said, if only you knew the gift of God. She didn't. She was distracted. She was all over the ship. And he says, well, if only you knew the gift of God. The water I'll give you. You've given me some water, darling, and that's lovely because I was thirsty and I thank you. But the water that I'll give you will become a spring of water gushing up within you to eternal life. And on a later occasion, he promised that rivers of living water would flow from the heart of those who believe in him. Rivers of love. At the Last Supper, we hear Jesus say, if you love me, keep my word. And the Father will love you. It's not, the Father's love isn't dependent on your loving. The Father can't but love you. He can't be without you. So he's the lover, but it doesn't get in unless you welcome it, unless I welcome it, unless we stop being so distracted and get in touch with the heart. And if we welcome it, it gives God great delight, of course, but we're free not to welcome it. And he says, if you love me, you'll keep my word, said Jesus, and my Father will love you. The love, in other words, will land, it'll reach you, it'll connect, and we'll come to you and make our home in you. It's one of the most rich, isn't it, Trinitarian understandings of our life. And Jesus concludes the Last Supper with the prayer, as you, Father, and his prayer must have been very effective. Not that it needed to change God, but it opened him up and everyone round him up, including us. As you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us. So that the love with which you loved me may be in them, and so that I may be in them. And John of the Cross, who's the topic of our week together, he speaks of God dwelling in us and gracing us with his love. And to quote from the Living Flame, God says to each of us, I'm yours, I'm for you, I'm delighted to be what I am so as to be yours and give myself to you. This is the God, the only God that we know. And the whole of creation is telling us this. The whole of art is wanting to say it. Even if an atheist creates a beautiful piece of architecture, God love him. You've got to tap him on the shoulder and say, stop all this stupid stuff. You're not an atheist. Look what you just did. You can't do that without God. You're in love with God, you silly old bugger, excuse the expression. So give in to it and stop narrowing your world down to this wonderful, controlling scientific world that's so important and so liberating if you put it in its right place. But don't be locked into it. I'm yours, says God. I'm for you. I'm delighted to be what I am so that I can be yours and give myself to you. Now, all morning we've been talking about the heart. Let the scriptures tell us a little bit about it. Sirach. He's written some rubbish, I have to tell you. And if you're a woman, you would have noticed it. But he's doing his best. And he's 200 years before Christ, so don't knock him. He didn't know Jesus, so he can't be... Hell, you don't ask too much of him. But one of the nice things he says... Heed the counsel of your own heart. No one's more faithful to you than is your own heart. Your soul often forewarns you. It's better than seven watchmen in a tower. All the experts around telling you what to do and where to go and what you should be doing and all your spiritual directors in the world, and they're all, good luck, it's okay. But for God's sake, he says, listen to your own heart. No one's more faithful to you than is your own. Because your own heart is, it's a three-letter word beginning with G, God is the heart and the beyond of everything. He's not telling us to follow our own heart privately, blindly, because his next sentence is, while you heed your heart, beg the Most High to guide you in the path of truth. In other words, it's your conscience he's interested in, not just your feelings or my feelings or my preferences or your preferences or our way of looking at things or my rights or all that stuff that the world is so full of. It isn't that. When he says get in touch with your heart, he means get in touch with God. Listen to the word that's being spoken to you. Listen to the invitation. Listen to the call. Listen to the cry. The one calling, that's God. Proverbs also stresses the importance of the human heart. More than all else, keep watch over your heart, since there are the well springs of life. The danger is that we mightn't have been loved enough to realize our heart is a beautiful place. That can happen. Well, open up and let it happen. Let it happen that it is a beautiful place. We've just seen enough to tell us that, but it's true. So finding oneself for some can be easier, for some can be a lot harder because of life experiences and hurts and the rest of it. I must believe that if I could get right into my own heart, I'd find something beautiful. I'd find God. But when we get halfway in, we get a bit iffy, and then we get busy. And what I do is I write a lecture on prayer because it's a lot easier than praying. So, well, I've got my own little ways of doing it, and you've probably got your little tricks too of distracting yourself, I don't know. So we're to listen humbly and attentively to others, listening for God's word, listening below the words to what the heart is saying. But we must remember that God dwells within us and God respects our heart. And when God speaks his word to us, we'll know. The spirit within us will say yes to what we hear. It's a connection. Heart speaking to heart. And there's a little diagram of that. And that's what we mean by revelation. The veil goes, and you know this, when the word and the spirit connect. Any word, when nature, the word of God in nature, touches you and your heart leaps and connects, your spirit leaps and connects. The word and the spirit are the revelation. That's communion with God. When the word made flesh, Jesus, that's the best, speaks, the spirit of Jesus in our hearts says yes, and when they come together, we're in communion with God. There is no other way. That's it. Heart speaking to heart. This is the conclusion of this morning. John 1:18, that's an icon of Jesus, of course. Up the left-hand side of that big C with a tail is actually the Greek cursive capital S. So IS is Jesus, isn't it? Christos, the first and last letters in Greek of Christ. So Jesus Christ. Ho Hagios Johannes is St. John, the evangelist, which you know. A little bit of French for those of you who like French. And you can guess, if you don't know French, you'd still work that out. You can see the word fiancé in the second line. I will fiancé you, I will betroth you, à moi, to me, dans la tendresse, in, there it is in English, tenderness. Hosea, I will betroth you to myself in tenderness. And round here, ho, on, is the divine name. The Septuagint, the Greek Bible, when it translated Yahweh, the Hebrew name for this inexpressible mystery, translated it ego eimi ho'on, ho'on, the being, the one. Because there is only God, and all of us participating, including the trees and the dogs and the everything, the birds of the air, all of us participating in unique ways in the one being that is God. Our problem is getting out of touch with the heart and distracted and sinning and missing the mark. No one, says this lovely disciple at the end of his life, no one's ever seen God. And if you're looking for something other than the bird or the animal or the person, you're not looking for God. To find God, we have to penetrate to the heart of the dog, the bird, the tree, the person, yourself. That's where we find the mystery. So no one's ever seen God. And the more you see, the more you see of God. You see of God. It's the Son who is in the bosom of the Father, and that's where John was. So he knew that's where Jesus was in relation to his Father God, listening to the heart. He has made him known. Okay, so that was my best shot at trying to talk about God. So we can relax from now on. And I'll go into those virtues that I promised last night we'd look at before we begin our spiritual canticle. Love, humility, obedience, and detachment. So that two this afternoon, two tomorrow, and then your wings will have spread by then, and then we'll soar in a spiritual canticle. And as I see all of you levitating, I promise I'll just tiptoe out of the room, go back to my room. So thank you.